I'm Tom Slava, Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. Over a year ago, TSIA published a framework titled Model-Driven Revenue. In that framework, we describe a world where customer data and AI models proactively drive customer engagement activities that result in revenue growth. Well, today, we have a guest that co-founded a company that is making that vision a reality. Today, I'm going to be joined by Alok Shukla. He is the CEO and co-founder of Funnel Story. It's an AI startup that has created something they call an AI-powered revenue intelligence layer. And I think this is some really cool shit. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Alok, welcome to Tectonic. I'm going to get right into it. I started by saying that you have this AI-powered revenue intelligence layer. Let's just start there. Explain that to the audience. What exactly is it?
See, we have lived in the age of end-to-end solutions, like for a long time. Like, we have two kind of solutions. You can think about an Apple model, where from the soups to the nuts, everything is provided by one company. The operating system, the hardware, the software on top of that, pretty much everything. Maybe they allow you to install your own software, but that was the Apple ecosystem. Microsoft designed another ecosystem where you had somebody's OS, somebody's machine, somebody's software, somebody's PC, and you basically create a PC or like a software systems like that. For a long time, the revenue systems were designed, if you look at a revenue solution, they were end-to-end. Like, I own the data, on top of that, I will provide you the UI, I will provide you the intelligence on top of that, and I will do everything. What's now happening is that we are entering the Lego block approach of revenue stack. And it's getting fragmented in the way that what you do best, you do that. We already have data warehouses that are already fragmented. We have people data sometimes lives in Salesforce, sometimes that lives in warehouses and so forth and so on. But then you have the intelligence of how your data meant from a business point of view. That was locked and loaded inside the nitty-gritties of CRM or some kind of a revenue intelligence tool, which basically told you, this is the intelligence and this is what you can do about it. What is now happening is that this layer is coming along individually, which basically says, on top of your data, this is the context of your business. This is the DNA of your business. This is what is happening. These are the most interesting things that are happening to you. That is available as a layer. Now you can run whatever software on top of that, wherever you want to achieve it. You can run it out of Claude. You can run it on ChatGPT. You can run it on your UI. You can run it on your app. You can do whatever you want to, wherever you want. So that's the premise from a layer perspective, that architecture that is coming up. If you think about it, people want to work in Claude these days. People want to work in ChatGPT. How about they can get that intelligence that was locked and loaded into CRMs directly into Claude so they can make decisions, they can take action from there. So that's the infrastructurization of the revenue intelligence. That is what is coming. That's what we offer.
Interesting. So I, you know, doing a little bit of research here, you have basically built a business around the idea that traditional dashboards, as you're describing, people have a system. Maybe that CRM gives me a dashboard and tells me some stuff. That is dated, misleading. What is the difference about your approach? Because you have this revenue intelligence layer. Help the audience understand why this is so different.
So why that is different? So first of all, there are some technological advances that have happened. One of the advances that have happened is that usually, historically, when you are creating an intelligence or creating a prediction or creating a modeling about whether a deal will close, whether a customer would be retained, that was primarily based on what is we call as structured data.
Yeah.
Structured data basically means your usage, your revenue, your activities data. That's what you talked about. And unstructured data, which is like conversational data, where you are actually discussing things, that was considered a signal, but that was not part of the model of the intelligence, how you calculate the model. So one of the things we did was that we invented a composite model where you can combine the structured and unstructured data, and in fact, also including third-party business intelligence. How that company is doing in the market. Will that company survive? Is that going to do something? So that you provide a pre-calculated intelligence that can help your sales team or your success teams make decisions. Apart from that, there is a historical timeline perspective. For a long time, for example, you know, Salesforce. One of the struggles for Salesforce is that it doesn't know how to handle the time series data. What has? It tells you what the story is today, but if it tells you how you reached that story over the last 6 months, it doesn't know anything. Uh-huh. It cannot tell you. And that is important for many times, especially that what are the early risk signals, early warning signals that happen much before things go bad or things go good. And that is very important for salespeople or renewal people to intervene before things go wrong or intervene much before things are bigger so that they can kind of manage the opportunity. And these kind of technologies now we can do based on creating a graph-like structure by combining all the structured and unstructured data. Traverse through the graph so that you can generate that kind of go back in time, come back out, and generate that intelligence. Now, that is something that lives in the system. And that makes the entire premise extremely powerful, extremely unique. I'm just giving two examples, but there are a lot more examples of these kind of intelligence that can live there. Now, these intelligence can, in a today's time, can be used in a UI for a salesperson to look at. It can also be used by an agent. How will agent consume the data? Agent doesn't need a UI. It can work with the data. It needs to provide data in a contextual format in which the agent can work. And that's what the premise is. Doesn't make sense. It's a long answer, but I just wanted to provide you a full parking.
To play some of that back, again, just for the audience, you know, in a traditional world, again, let's say you're tracking a customer, you have a CRM, and you may have a dashboard, red, yellow, green, and that dashboard is being driven by structured information an account manager or CSM might have put in about that account. That is our history. You're describing a world where you can bring in, yes, the structured data, unstructured data, past phone conversations, past emails, you know, et cetera, third-party data, like you said, what's going on in the market, bring it all together and then intelligently model for an account rep, a CSM or whatever, to say, hey, this is what the real health of the customer is. This is what's really going on. Here's where you have an issue. Here's, you know, you should intervene, et cetera. So it is a massively different game. I mean, you know, way more insightful. And like you said, also you put on the table the ability to go back and understand how you got there, not just look at the snapshot in time, is also very powerful. So I get that. And again, that is 100% aligned with our point of view around model-driven revenue, that you're using these very sophisticated models to really understand, you know, what's going on there. And make it tangible for me in terms of just some specific examples where by having these models in place, you've seen customers be able to either take friction out or interact more effectively with the customer. Just how's this playing out and rubber meets the road?
Yeah. So one of the concepts that we developed is a concept called needle movers. So it's like this. Think about, let's say you go to a doctor and you say, doctor, I might have diabetes. And doctor says that, okay, let me test your blood. And it says, you don't have diabetes, but guess what? It looks like you have high blood cholesterol. You might have high triglycerides. A lot of things that doctors say that are highly correlated to the onset of diabetes doesn't mean that you will get it. It's just early warning signals. And these are some things that if you focus on that early on, you can fix those things. Something what we call pre-diabetic or the warning signals, right? But how these correlated items were come about? Because doctors and medical professionals have analyzed historical data for a long time. What happens before a person gets diabetic? What happens before that? 3 to 6 months before, 9 months before. And they are not like saying that it's going bound to happen. It says that it might happen. But it provides you a runway. And a runway is the most important thing for a salesperson or a renewal person to change things. So the point here is that in this case, this concept was materialized as a concept for needle movers. We said, based on historical data, these are the kind of things that proceed before things start to happen. So now what you do is you start watching that conversation, watching that usage behavior, watching that cohort analysis, and look for those patterns. And you basically say, okay, this issue is coming up, and we are consolidating multiple events that is coming up. So we have lots of customers who basically said that, okay, in one case, I will explain to you. There was a unique case that when a CEO of the company went to the customer and the customer side basically told them, the counterpart there, that, hey, your product is pretty interesting. We love it. There was one feature that we were thinking about that is in your competitive product. What do you think about that? And it was a casual conversation across the day. He didn't think much about it. that was on a recorded conversation or in a note, somebody took a note and put that into the system. 1 month later, a support ticket came to somebody very junior.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, can you, I'm putting a feature request, can you support that feature? Two different hierarchies. They are not talking to each other. And the third person, who is the median level, he also came in and he had a conversation with an account exec or a CSM, and he basically said, okay, this is the feature. Can you tell us how we can support that or some other feature also from the same competition? The funnel story, in fact, what they call the needle movers, basically said they are interested, they are competitively evaluating. There are three proof points across three time ranges, across three different hierarchy of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we are highlighting is because this kind of behavior we have seen in the deals that churned out. 6 to 9 months back.
Yeah.
Something in a normal behavior, it would not be possible for you to even capture that six. So that happened. They basically figured out and they basically reached out to them that we would love to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
How can we support your business? What is missing?
Yeah.
But unless you have that, it's like you're sitting on a flow of data, but there's no intelligence.
Yeah. The ability to bring visibility across all those different interactions, all these different channels, because again, our history, right? Let's say there is a customer success manager who's working with that account and says, look, they're happy. They're not complaining, you know, good interaction. It's all thumbs up. And then meanwhile, like you said, there's these little signals that are trickling in that this is important to them at all different levels. And again, being able to bring that all together is super powerful. So here's a question though I have with model-driven revenue like this. And I know that a lot of our members have this question. I think they see the power of doing this, right? They realize, hey, this is clearly going to be the future of how we interact with our customers. I think one thing people really are trying to get their heads around right now is how long does it take for, let's say, an enterprise company, tech company, to get their model tuned, right? In other words, you come in, you put this intelligent layer in place, start getting all these signals, right? Structured, unstructured, et cetera. But you don't know the answers that they want, right? You've got to build and tune that model. Just give me a sense of how long does that usually take before you start getting really good insights from the model?
Actually, the median time to deploy is less than a day.
Yeah? Really?
Yeah, median time to deploy is less than a day and gets to a value. And this is as fast as possible. It's not, but in these times, it's not a pretty big deal because the reason why that happens is because there's a lot of historical data in a company. So what used to happen is that historically, a year back, for example, you get into an organization and you start to learn from that point of time. You did not have a cold start, as it is called.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, in our system, because of the patent that we filed, is that we come to this day and reverse engineer your entire back channel timeline, like what happened in the last 2 years.
Got it.
And then we say, this deal closed. Go back in time, reverse engineer. What happened before that? What happened before that? So build the entire timeline, start to do an analysis of the past, and then build and train your model on top of the historical data. So the day one,
uh-huh.
You're basically saying, based on what happened in the last 2 years, I know what to recommend to.
Interesting. So you're able to leverage. So yeah, we'll just pick on churn. You can look at all this historical data. Let's say I know what customers churned on me over the last 3 years. Then you're going back and looking at what those accounts did, what those interactions were, what the patterns were. That trains the model to say, okay, so moving forward here, here's your highest risk of churn, you know, based on these models. Do I have that correct? So that's why you're able to have the insights. So that gets you out of the gate. And then do the models get better and better as you're moving forward then?
Of course, because intelligence is not the only thing.
Uh-huh.
What kind of actions are taken? Because you also recommend actions.
Yeah.
Take these actions. And based on those actions, did they improve? Did they impact something?
Yeah.
Because once you're recommending actions, you don't need to understand whether those actions made a change. What are the sequence of those actions? What kind of pathway takes you to success? What kind of pathway doesn't take you to success? And that starts to conform the model over a period of time.
So I'm glad you put that on the table because, again, we are a believer that whether it's a salesperson or a CSM, whoever, they're going to wake up in the morning and not try to sort of guess what accounts to talk to or what to do. The model is going to be informing them, right? The model is going to be saying, hey, you know, account A over here, you definitely want to run this intervention. We're concerned about it, whatever. And what you've just put on the table is the living, breathing part of this is that companies are going to be constantly improving their playbooks, is what I heard there. And in other words, I ran into actions, that led to, you know, they didn't churn or led to expansion. I tried these actions. They're not as effective. So you're getting smarter, I assume, right? You're getting smarter and smarter because you can just keep tracking instead of just guessing like, oh, we've always done this for problematic customers. Let's hope it works. It's like you're going to have the actual data continually improving your playbooks.
Absolutely.
And then so the other thing you commented quickly there was that these actions don't have to be done by people. They can be done by agents as well. So this, you know, the agents can be using the model and say, oh, I am going to run this type of intervention on behalf of the company here. Give me a sense of like what percentage of interventions do you see being executed by agents now versus still, you know, a human?
I think that is something is still up in the air. And the reason is that because there is an agentic maturity curve that is still happening in the organization. While people want to say that they do a lot of agents, but essentially what they're doing is small tasks, letting the salesperson do something, making them more productive, rather than the agent doing something directly by themselves. So that's a general purpose kind of a discovery. But from an agent perspective, the way people are trying to dip their feet is into small actions, where some level of intervention to observe what things are going on. Let me give an example. One of the things that is coming up pretty strongly is, it's a very thing that you normally don't think about it, but it started to happen, is there's a sales leader who has the job of observing how the sales teams are operating on a day-to-day basis, or a customer success leader is operating, how the customer success teams are doing. And they have created the playbooks, the process, the workflows, and everything they have done, but somebody has to manage on a long basis. Now, because the data is in the system and there is a context graph that is already getting created and managed on every day, you can basically ask an agent now that rather than me asking, can you just observe this data and start to question people on my behalf?
Yeah, interesting.
So there's an agent, which is a long-running agent that is actually observing the system and managing and poking them. Hey, you have to do this, you have to do that. Who did that happen? Can you send a report? Because this is something looks like, can I intervene? And can I tell you how to do about it? Or maybe ask the leader, hey, this person might need help, but do you want to intervene? This is takes a lot of burden to run those weekly meetings, those staff meetings, those business reviews. It's just on.
Yeah.
It's an efficiency perspective. It's astonishingly simple idea, but you think, wow.
Yeah, well, I mean, and if you think about managing in general, I mean, that's one of the painful things, is all of that sort of that nitty gritty grunt work you're talking about, where you're like, I got to make sure that this CSM is following the playbook, or the salesperson has done that. And so wrapping an agent, you know, around that to provide those guardrails, I think is super interesting. I want to talk about the human side of this though then. So my follow-up question is, you now have these agents that are helping to manage, you know, for you on your behalf, reminding people to do this, do that. How are employees reacting to that, right? So now I'm a salesperson and the agent is saying, hey, Thomas, don't forget to do this, do that, do this follow-up call. What are you seeing there?
I think that's pretty interesting because this is early days.
Yeah.
As is the case with onset of any new technologies, there are always resistance and there are always things where it gets adopted. I think if the reps have the freedom to decide what they do with the intelligence, they find it authentic. Mm-hmm. The moment they think that it is part of the process, they find it uncomfortable unless it is run as a process by the leader.
Interesting.
If you let it people like adopt the technology and just do without telling them a mandated thing, the initial deployment curve is pretty, sometimes becomes slower. And one of the interesting reasons about it is that a lot of frontline reps are thinking about some of these technologies as kind of judgmental about them.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One of the things which is a very natural motivation is that for a lot of people, I'm not talking about a top performer, but there are always a lot of either moderate performers or lower performers, or which always is any sales or customer success organization lies in, right? And those folks want to always talk about how their accounts are doing well till the point they are not doing well.
Right,
how it's going to work absolutely fine. They don't like to give bad news because they think it's a reflection on them.
Yep.
So what happens is that AI doesn't have that sentimentality.
That's right.
It will do what it has to do. And so if there is something else that can tell the story while they're telling something, it becomes very nervous.
Yeah.
It's on a human level. It's very kind of, it's a big brother watching it. So that's what's happened. But if it made a process, how it is rolled out, then it becomes successful. So I've seen both examples. On the other hand, at the leadership level, actually, leadership generally are the organization, they are looking for counter advice. They don't want people who agree with them because their entire job depends on taking care of the unplanned situation and deal with them pretty fast. Yeah. So for them, AI is actually built for them. So if you have a leadership trait and you want to be given information of the unknown beforehand and give them suggestions, they actually appreciate it. For the people down the chain, it can be a shift. Does it make sense?
It does. And it's very much aligned with some research I was reading. If you look at AI adoption right now, corporate America, you're starting to see this bifurcation where leaders, managers, you know, more senior people are leaning in harder and harder on AI. They see the potential of it. They see the benefits, which you just articulated, the, you know, getting accurate and honest assessments on town health and revenue, et cetera. You know, you're a vice president and owns a, you care. I mean, you want that number to be as right as possible. Your job depends on it. But then this bifurcation is the people that are more frontline are more nervous about, you know, the technology, more nervous, what, like you said, is it really sort of big brothering and being critical of my skills, et cetera. And so I think that there is definitely a change management leadership skill set there as you're deploying these kind of systems to make sure that people are comfortable, they see the benefits. And by the way, I mean, I think for everybody in that food chain and the frontline professionals, these tools are helpful, not hurtful. I mean, they're going to make you a better account rep. They're going to help you do a better job of meeting your revenue numbers or whatever your KPIs are on those accounts. And so you want to lean into it because these models can do things you will never be able to do by yourself. Never. And so, but you need that landing with employees, right? They have to lean in. And I'm curious, kind of a related question. Is there any difference you see? Because one thing you said, you know, letting people lean into the technology, not being too heavy-handed rolling it out. Well, what is the difference you're seeing? Because, you know, you can put this intelligence revenue layer in and it can come up with these brilliant, smart, accurate recommendations to go work on accounts. And my gut is some companies you see employees lean into it. They're like, that's so helpful. They actually execute those actions. And in other companies, they look at them and go, nah, you know, I know better. I don't want to do that. What creates the difference there? You know, what are the attributes of companies that really do embrace the recommendations and follow up on them?
I think it's a lot of what I'm seeing is, especially in the world of AI, it's very flaky. So a lot of implementations are flaky. They are not long-term, unless you have long-term contracts. But it also is how the leaders think about it. It's still not standardized. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of leaders which are rebel in the old ways. They have their reasons. They have done very well, and they don't want to change this. They of course they think about some of these choices. Like, comes in, does the job, and you are a revenue leader. Ultimately, the CEO also cares about is how much you are making money, unless there is a cost pressure.
Right.
See, the cost pressure is actually driving more AI adoption than the revenue pressure.
Yep.
Because if you have to manage with less number of people and do more things, that becomes a thing where a lot of time the AI gets adopted. Revenue is not a given outcome. And it's hard to attribute what is coming from AI. So if from an organization perspective, I would say it's the leadership, how they think about the organization that is driving the most meaningful or not the most meaningful outcome. It's a very personality driven at this point of time. And also the perseverance. One thing is to say adopt the technology, but just after 3 months, you don't want to cut the cord and just run away. You have to persevere. You have to believe that this can happen. So it's also, it's far more, I think, powerful in the younger folks rather than the people who are slightly older, which is normal with any cycle of technology adoption.
Yeah. So when I look into that, what you're seeing, that reality of more adoption around the cost, you know, we have to adopt AI because it's saving us money, the revenue side of it, they're like slower leaning in. We see the same thing at TSIA. And I would put a couple things on the table. I think that for executive teams, they are so fixated on the cost saving side, they are missing this massive opportunity on the revenue side, because I think AI capabilities is going to be just as revolutionary for the, you know, revenue modeling, the interventions, reducing churn, accelerating expansion, because again, it can do things that no individual can do. And so there's huge upside. And I think everybody's just so fixated on how do I have less support people or less CS people or whatever, you know, because I now have AI. They're missing this opportunity. So I think there's a big opportunity. Number two, like you, I see this bifurcation in personas for revenue leaders. I think there are a lot of what I'll call old school revenue leader. If you want to know the forecast, you get that by calling up and interviewing all of your directors, sales agents. You can make your number this month, yes or no. That's the way they roll. But there is a new generation of revenue leaders who are very data-driven, very analytics, very model-driven. And that is where the game is going to be played for sure moving forward. So it's going to be interesting to see how fast this evolution actually occurs on the revenue side. And of course, you have a front row seat to it. So I'm sure you're having fun watching it. I want to ask another question in terms of when companies start to deploy this type of technology, what is the ripple effect you're seeing around organizational structure? Because we, historically, we have a very stovepipe world, right? You have salespeople over here, and you may have a CSM over here, you might have a support person over there. They're different organizations doing different things, different processes, different systems, all that stuff. Now you put this intelligent layer that is bringing all of this together. Is it impacting the way people start thinking about the organizational structure? You know, is there, because we believe there's more convergence to be had here instead of all these stovepipes. But what are you seeing?
No, that's a powerful thing because I am seeing something very interesting. And I think I will tell you that this is something, I'm glad you asked me this question. See, there are, in North America, there are almost, if you go to LinkedIn, there are almost 1.5 million people who are in business intelligence, success ops, revenue ops, your support ops, and product ops. If you think from a data structure, data point of view and product point of view, you had a common warehouse, the BI people were reporting for the leadership, and the same data set is, in some way or another, is also being used by all the four parties, by their own ops teams. And the reason was that because everybody was looking at the data differently. What is happening with AI and agents is that they are not part of a department. Right? And once you write an agent, there is nothing, you change the prompt and it will do something else. So what you are going to see is that the intelligence and information system are collapsing. So it's a technology that is driving a change very powerfully. So the, when I talk about the intelligence layer, because it's a very AI driven, it can answer a question. If you ask a question about sales, it will answer from a sales perspective. But if you ask from what are the feature requests that you're seeing, it can analyze the same data from a different lens. It doesn't need to have a different department. Once that starts to happen, one of the question obvious comes in, what is the ops layer looks like? Who are the people? Or it becomes a democratized intelligence because there's a central intelligence. Anybody can ask the same question to anybody. I mean, the only thing that you want to watch out for is that, okay, I have responsible book to market, so I don't want to show the revenue, what is coming up and what we are projecting to the outside world. But apart from that, that kind of a role-based access on who can see what data, the entire organization is one. So this is not about if, it's about just when. Because that's the nature of the tech. The agents do not belong to a function. They are just, by the nature of it, they are amorphous. They can move around. They are just one group technology. Actually happening right now, that kind of thing. Go ahead.
No, as you say, I mean, I think that, that simple statement that agents do not belong to an organization is really powerful. I've never heard that phrasing, but it strikes, it really hits me because that, you know, people are very defensive of their organizations. You know, they're defensive of their data sets, of their reports, of their analysis, right? And it's like, I've got this view, the other group has that view. That's always been a challenge. And like you say, when you put a layer in there, you put agents in there, that I'm agnostic. I'm not defending sales perspective. I'm not defending a service perspective on or a product perspective. I am just, you know, looking for the truth and looking for the right things to do. It is going to be an accelerator for breaking down these traditional, you know, kingdoms
for sure.
It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. So I also want to ask you a couple other questions here that I'm keeping an eye on the clock. So we're in this AI gold rush for sure. And yet there's still a lot of companies that aren't leveraging AI specifically to understand the customers better. Again, maybe they might be focused on the cost reduction. But when you go in and start working with companies, what's holding some companies back? Is it the leadership doesn't believe AI can help them here? Is it that their data is messed up? Is it they don't have the skills to really deploy AI? What do you think are some of the biggest challenges in what they call that last mile, you know, of deployment?
I think this is a lot about their fears. If you talk about the people who are on the ground, some of the people whose whole job was to do hard work, which can be done by AI, but they are scared that it can take them, so they want to resist as much as possible. Then there are leadership for whom it's a big deal. I will give you an example here. So what is happening to revenue and customer success teams, both sides of the house, is something that happened in cybersecurity over 20 years back. And the reason I'm bringing this is because my background actually comes from cybersecurity.
Okay.
I spent 20 years managing products and engineering at companies like McAfee, Intel, Intersecurity, Imperva, Shiftleft. And 20 years back, if you used to call somebody, hey, I'm not able to log in, there was somebody who used to pick up the phone, they used to guide the people you what to do about it. Now, this entire system is automated. We don't need to call somebody, right? So those departments were called SOC, Security Operations Center, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you go back 20 years, that was pretty much built by people, humans. They were the people who were doing the job.
Yep.
And if you look at the leader, they were managing people's budget,
mm-hmm.
right? But mm-hmm. over 20 years, right now, that entire sector is like 30% people and 70% tech. So the kind of our leaders who used to manage people, either they had to adapt to managing tech and changing the how they think about organizations, what are the KPIs of the organizations. So that kind of change in cybersecurity required some people to walk out, some people to change, but a lot of new leaders started to emerge who could envisage an organization where more than half of the organization would be AI agents and tech.
Yeah, right?
So what I saw in the change in cybersecurity will last for 20 years, I believe that can happen here. So if you look at any person, let's say any individual who is managing, let's say 20 sales reps, and say you are paying $100K to them. So at a minimum, you are managing it for $2 million salary budget.
Yeah.
Now, what was going to happen is you might be managing over a period of time $800K of revenue budget, people's budget, and $1.2 million of software budget.
Yeah.
That requires a different skill set.
Yeah.
That requires you to think very what kind of people you want. Because that also improves the skill set of the people. Because as I said to a lot of people, and I say it partly in jest, but partly just to make a point, 20 years back, the movie came Matrix. There was an architect whose whole job was to manage the agents. Right? You were the architect of the Matrix. You were creating that Matrix in which what agent have to do. When the agent were faulty, they used to take them out. You are looking for that kind of a skill set of person. You are thinking about creating that kind of an organization. But that requires you to first think, are you skilled enough? Are you even thinking about this? Technology by itself is not going to do this thing. There is an entire class of organization learning that has to happen. An organization like yours, they have to come up with an agentic maturity model on how these organizations should think. What is the revenue agentic maturity model? Yes, the technology would get adopted. But now, what would be the role of a revenue leader when they manage more technology than people? What would be the role of admins, like the sales ops person? Are they the people of managing data? Are they managing intelligence?
Yep.
Admins. What is the role of the frontline reps? Are they managing their own business, or are they managing a fleet of agents?
Yeah. This is a really fascinating thread to me, because there's a body of research that we're doing right now, which we call Services 2.0. And what you do is you look at every function, let's pick on professional services within a tech company, and you say, what's the current state, 1.0? And to your point, that's probably pretty people intensive, et cetera. Well, what is 2.0 going to start to look like? There are some capabilities that continue, just like your SOC example. There are some people that were leading SOCs 20 years ago. Those skills are still relevant today. But there's a whole new set of, you know, so we call those bridge capabilities. But there's a whole new set of ways to do things and skills. And to your point, I love this framing, the fact that in this 2.0 world, the organization, I don't care if you're leading professional services, a support organization, a sales organization, the organization you are leading now, the mix of that is going to be fundamentally different. And again, the way your workflows and the way you're doing business is fundamentally different. But instead of, and again, that's probably correct, instead of it being 70% people or 80% people, 20% tech, it's going to be maybe not completely flipped, but it's going to be very different. It might be, like you said, 60, 70% of what I'm managing is tech, augmented by people that are now super productive in these tools. So it is Interesting. Let me ask two follow-up questions on your SOC example. How long did it take for you to see that leadership change?
10 to 15 years.
Yeah. Okay. So that was going to be my guess. I was going to say about a decade at least.
It would take a generation, let's put it. And I will tell you why this is. This is not something people think about, some of these technologies that come past.
Yeah.
But they actually don't, because the organizational architectures takes a lot of time, because it's like you to make a change for your own habits is easier. You to make a change, however, how people interact with each other, it's a training. It's a system. It's a process in place. It's AI was not going to do by itself. That is an organizational decision how to do that. I will take a different example. Like 25 years back, if you remember, electric cars came in. GM came up with Volt.
Yep.
You remember, Volt actually came 25 years back.
Uh-huh.
And that was dumped that time. And then Tesla came in and it created a new model, how that technology can be used on a day-to-day. Because people realized there were no charging networks. It's not about the car. It's about getting caught up in somewhere in middle of the desert without having a charging, right, capability. So technology by itself cannot change this unless there are process, people, technology set up to manage that. And I say this, and a lot of time, like I was at a TSI conference, and one of the fear I had in like one year back, your leader was saying, and I'm just paraphrasing, is, are we going to be there as a TSI itself, services itself, AI going to do everything? But now I think you are also more clear that it's not going to just happen.
Right.
You need to educate and create a set of new policies, new organizational metrics, how to even think about organization. People don't know about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am struggling. I see this. I struggle with this sometimes. That it's not my job. People ask me, what kind of agent should I implement? I said, that's a very deeper question. What kind of agent means what kind of processes are going to exist? Because you are asking a question about your GTM, essentially. You have, when you ask me a question, what agent should I implement? What kind of software I should implement? It's the question they are actually asking is, how do I work now?
Right.
That question is not going to come from a vendor.
Yeah.
That
will
come from industry bodies. There had that, and I will be honestly saying that I think that research and a leadership in this area is missing, because this is a huge opportunity. I mean, a lot of AI implementation you will see in 1 or 2 years is going to come to naught, and the main reason would be that people didn't realize how their organization was looked like. That is a big question.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I think that there's a couple really interesting variables, and you've been around for a while like I have, and we have seen other technologies come that were new, right? So if it was client server, and it was internet, it was editor, and everybody had to, you know, learn and adjust to those. But there's a couple things that are wildly different about this time. And one is here, the power that these AI tools unlock, the potential ROI in these different use cases is mind-blowing, and you know that. It's just that, I mean, when people said, oh, I could go to SaaS and move to the cloud, okay, there's savings or whatever, that's peanuts compared to what we're talking about now. So there's big dollars, big things on the table for executive teams to try to go after. So there's a lot of excitement around that. Second thing is people are fixated on both the technology and the cost savings right now, which I think, to what you're chipping on, that is not the thing to be so fixated on. You should be fixated, like you're talking about, how are we going to operate as an organization with these types of tools, with agents, with this, with that, you know, all these capabilities. What does the future of a revenue organization look like, a service organization, product development? Those are going to be the big, hard questions for AI adoption in enterprise. And the companies that I think, you know, what attributes I'm looking for is, you know, companies that are embracing that uncertainty and that are willing to experiment. I mean, I had a call today with a very large software company this morning, meeting with their executive team, and they kept bringing up these problems. We're talking about outcome value-based pricing, and they kept bringing up these problems that have been on the table for decades, but they're the old school problems. You know, we don't have the data, we don't have visibility, but, you know, all these reasons why we can't do it. I'm like, you folks keep thinking about a world that is 5 years old. We are operating in a completely different world now with these technologies. And so you got to lose that baggage, right? And embrace it. And it's going to be tough for a lot of leaders, a lot of companies. It's going to be super interesting to watch. I mean, it's exciting times, but it is also simultaneously, I think, terrifying for a lot of leadership teams.
So one of the things that you gladly made the point, I talk to a lot of people who are, when you talk to me, I don't have enough data. I don't have the right set of data to make judgments higher. And because I never grew up in the GTM background itself, I grew up in the cybersecurity background. I tell them a lot of time, I said, you realize that cybersecurity guys don't complain about this. It's like, because we are in a policing work. Uh-huh. When a crime happens, we go to a situation and we say, we will work with the evidence as it exists, uh-huh. not what is ideal.
Yeah, yeah.
If the police or the cybersecurity people started to work on the ideal rather than what exists, right. we will never be able to do the job. So if you realize that, when I told you that my deployment time is less than a day, we basically had developed these kind of technologies in cybersecurity world a long time back. Work with the data, create a model, test out the model, how much confidence you have on the data that you exist today, and then work on improving that on a layer-by-layer basis.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
whatever data is available, it always gives you insight. I think there is going to be a lot of perlocation of intelligence in the process from the industries who have managed a lot more technologies, like cybersecurity is the infrastructure world compared to the GTM, customer success, or many of the technologies which are very people-driven. So there has to be some kind of transfer intelligence. And there's a lot of examples that can be thought from this. Not all industries are same. Some industries are far ahead in how they have adopted technology. Some industries don't.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're seeing is a gap. And I see this in this revenue and success world. It's so people-driven.
Yeah.
Which is the way it ought to be. But I think there is a lot of learning which has happened in other fields.
Yes.
How to manage technology better. And there is a lot of corpus already about that. I'm sure you will see that thing. That are people who are in the tech world, or the cybersecurity world, they are not that afraid. They know how to manage these things. They have done it for a living, for a generation. They have the internal skill set to manage the change. But some of the other sectors, like when I do a demo of that agents doing things, I know somebody is sitting in Minneapolis in a sales and marketing agency who has never seen the tech, who has always done work with people. Their first reaction to seeing that is, wow, that's it.
Yeah.
They are still experiencing the apocalypse happening in front of their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to happen actually that way, but that's what I'm seeing. A lot of reactions. Sorry to bring that up. But I see this and I see the when you do a demo of the technology, then you see different faces based on where they're coming from, and you can see this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good point. I mean, I think, just to play that back, I mean, you look at any function within a company, some functions are much more adept at leveraging technology. It's been part of their DNA for a long time. And other functions, like you said, have just been very people-driven. That's the way they roll. And they just don't have the skill set yet to think about how they could be leveraging this incredible capabilities that's now here at our fingertips. It's crazy times. Well, I know I need to let you go here. I really appreciate you stopping in. The conversation was fantastic. And I think you're doing some really interesting things there. And I'm sure you're going to help a lot of these revenue leaders get through the knothole here. Now they can leverage AI. I always end these episodes with a question of the day. And so my question for the audience is, are you firing up your model-driven revenue engine? Cheers, everybody.